Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, and I'm absolutely thrilled to bring you the new season of Because That's What Heroes Do. This is the podcast for sci-fi aficionados who might have a compliance twinge to them, but together with Megan Doherty, my partner in this series, we explore science fiction series, science fiction movies, and science fiction stories. This season, we're going to take up Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and we're absolutely thrilled to be joined in this journey by Alex Murphy. We're going to take our top five shows each, so three times five for 15, top shows of DS9, and take a deep dive into them. We're going to take a look at the synopsis of each story, then we're going to take a review on some of the key plot lines as we saw them, take a look at how these plot points relate to not only DS9, but other series, and then consider some of our favorite cookies and Easter eggs. It's a great way to take a review of Deep Space Nine. The series premiered in 2003. It's one of my favorites. I thoroughly enjoyed the entire series. I've watched it straight through all seven seasons. And I know Megan and I and Alex will bring a passion to this podcast that you, the listener, will be able to relate to and enjoy. So, Because That's What Heroes Do, Season 5, Deep Space Nine. The award-winning Because That's What Heroes Do is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network. In today's episode, we take up the premiere of DS9, which appeared in two parts, Emissary, Parts 1 and 2. Although originally shown in two parts, Emissary is now usually condensed into one part, and it is the introduction of Deep Space Nine. It begins at the Battle of Wolf 359, where Starfleet is under attack by the Borg. Of course, the Borg had temporarily assimilated Jean-Luc Picard into Locutus of Borg. The battle was a rout, and the ship, commanded by Benjamin Sisko, was destroyed. He ordered his ship to be abandoned, and unfortunately, his wife died in the attack by the Borg. 3 years later, Sisko was assigned to command Deep Space Nine in the orbit of the planet Bajor, which was recently freed by, or rather from, the Cardassian. Bajor was a part of Deep Space Nine, and it has a commander, Major Kira Nerys, who is the first officer to Captain Sisko. Desperate to unify the Bajoran people, Sisko visits Bajor to meet with its spiritual leader, Kai Opoka, who tells Sisko that they believe he was sent from the prophets to communicate to them. Sisko also receives an unwelcome visit from the former Cardassian commander, Gul Dukat, who makes clear his interest in retaining not simply Bajor, but the mysterious orbs. These orbs come from the prophets, and there are nine in existence, eight of which are controlled by the Cardassians. So Dax and Sisko go out to investigate information they've received from one of the orbs that Kai Opoka has given to Sisko. In this exploration, they discover the first stable wormhole, which leads them to be able to travel to the Gamma Quadrant on the other side of the galaxy. As they attempt to return, Dax is transported or teleported back to DS9 while Sisko remains in the wormhole. Sisko has a series of discussions and adventures with the prophets in the wormhole that are some great science fiction. Kira, recognizing the wormhole's value, orders the station to be moved closer to its mouth so she can claim it on behalf of Bajor. This enrages the Cardassians who've come to investigate after Dukat has entered the wormhole and disappeared. There is a standoff between the Cardassians and DS9, and they order Kira to surrender DS9 and be destroyed. Sisko meets and talks with the beings of the wormhole, who do send him back to Deep Space Nine. He comes out of the wormhole with the Cardassian ship in tow, and Gul Dukat orders the Cardassians to stand down and stop their attack. Kira Nerys realizes that Bajor needs the Federation to stake its claim to the wormhole, so she welcomes the Federation in the form of Captain Sisko. Sisko has a final word with Jean-Luc Picard, whom he had opened the show with in a very tense scene, because, of course, Lucutus of Borg had been a part of the effort to, which led to the death of his wife. But it seems that Commander Sisko is ready now to take his role as the commander of DS9 and his exploration of the prophets. So, Murphy, as our newest member of Because That's What Heroes Do, we're going to start with you. What were some of your initial thoughts on Emissary?
Nice continuation from, you know, the mid-season of TNG. I mean, it's a good segue. Certainly a lot more fluid as a story than, say, Encounter at Farpoint, which is clunky, kind of hard to get a grasp on. But it's a good story. I mean, it focuses very heavily on one character. Everybody else is pretty peripheral. I thought it was funny that when you look at the credits, you see Rom for about 5 seconds, and he's only listed as Ferengi Pit Boss, which I thought was pretty good. It's a good story. It's a solid story. It gives you a good introduction to the series. I've always enjoyed it a lot. There's something about it that's sort of charming, in a weird way. And of course, the marvelous DS9 color pattern of purple and bronze, which is just everywhere. It's a good one. What were your thoughts?
Well, Megan, how about you?
It was so fun to go back and watch the pilot again for the first time. I've been telling you a little bit, Tom and Murphy, I think you know the story too, how my first watching of the pilot for the first time was one of my very early dates with my now spouse, where I was anxious about my inability to crochet as well as I had claimed I was able to. Yeah. So getting to see it again without kind of that underlying romantic anxiety was really, really pleasant. But kind of aside from that, it was hard to almost separate all the experiences we've had with these characters since then. Yeah. But really high level, I thought that just starting off the episode right back there at Wolf 359, you know, that really pivotal moment in the whole series, and then also for Sisko as an individual, was so good at pulling us right back into the story. And it almost reminded me of the beginning of Endgame, when Hawkeye was, you know, shown his family dusted and kind of just immediately sucking you right back into this world that you haven't been in for a while. So I thought that was such a beautiful choice. And then introducing all of the characters, Murphy, I think you're right. They were like, a lot of them were really like introduced quickly.
It's a very quick introduction.
So quick, but the introductions were so representative of who the characters would grow to be. Like, I think more so than in most pilots, they really captured the essences of the characters that they were going to be developing later on. So I thought, beautifully done. Tom, what did you think?
Well, it was a lot more intense than I remembered. Megan and I did a deep dive into The Best of Both Worlds, Parts 1 and 2, and Wolf 359.
Right.
And I thought that scene where Jennifer dies, obviously that was very poignant, but what I got out of that was just how hated is Picard because he became Lucutus of Borg.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Continue.
And so I, you know, he was very, and I remembered he met Picard, and that meeting was even more intense than I had remembered. So I've thought about Wolf 359 a lot, and I even posited that that was the pivot point of all Star Trek, that those two episodes and that battle. And so it was able to recall that. Kira Nerys, boy, she is one angry woman. And
with good reason.
And it really drove home for me the often difficult transition that a rebel or rebellion leader has to make when they move into government and administration. And the skills that served her so well as a rebel may not serve her as well as an administrator. I really like your point about two things, Murphy. One was the how much we focused on Cisco, and also your point about Farpoint, because in reading, doing some research for this episode, the screenwriters were people who had worked on the TNG series. They knew every inch and every word of every Bible, and they were well-versed, and it showed in this screenplay because they hit more cylinders than Farpoint did. I really thought that, I don't want to say professionalism, but their expertise and background in the Star Trek universe really showed true for me. So what did you have for us, Murphy?
No, I agree with your point specifically to, first of all, with that scene with Sisko and Picard. I mean, that is a moment that we haven't really seen before. In TNG, you know, Picard has his tense moments with people, but he's always kind of this revered guy. When Sisko says to him, you know, we met in battle, and the instant sort of stone face, his face just drops. And it's this progression, also in TNG, for a lot of things from that point aim, it's the hardening of Picard. It's this realization that he is not fully the person that he wants to be anymore, that he has lost a piece of himself. And this comes into play, you know, you see this in the right after Best of Both Worlds, when he visits his brother in France, you know, and he has that breakdown, and he says to his brother, you know, you don't know what they did to me. And I think you see this later on in First Contact too. You see him sort of losing this, but yeah, it's definitely a different dynamic than we've seen in him before. And I also have to wonder, I mean, talking about Kira Nerys, I wonder, since originally Michelle Forbes was supposed to play Kira's role, and it was supposed to be Ensign Ro going to DS9, leaving TNG, doing that, I wonder what a difference her character would have been. Someone who had been tempered by experience in Starfleet, had, you know, sort of been used to those protocols and been used to working with other races and working with Picard and having him as a mentor, what she would have been like as the, you know, the Bajoran attaché to the station. Whereas instead, like you said, we get Kira and she has to struggle to sort of transition into that role. I think it would have been interesting, but ultimately I love the choice that they made to go with someone new and someone right out of the trenches, as it were, who, you know, 2 weeks ago was sitting in a cave in Dakor province and is now like pretty much secondhand in charge of a station. So yeah, no, it's very interesting. They you're right. The writers did a really good job with that and really did a nice job of tying it into past TOS and the TNG Bible and stuff like that. Yeah.
I had watching that initial conversation between Picard and Sisko. And so when Picard realized where Sisko had been and what he had known about him, he didn't respond at all. He didn't say anything. And I was watching that. He's kind of walked away and then got back to the topic at hand. And I was wondering, was there anything he could have said then or should have said to Sisko?
I'm sorry,
Sisko,
I killed your wife? Yeah.
Something of that kind. But it really made me think about, I think
I wasn't exactly myself that day, you know?
I thought it was an interesting moment because he looked, the word I wrote down for it was defeated.
Yeah.
He was so much more defeated than you see him usually.
Yeah.
That's a great point. So, Megan, what did you think about as we move to the more spiritual aspect of the show where Sisko meets Kyle Paca and then is told about the orbs and what they might mean and that he indeed is the emissary? You know, if called, I will not serve. You know, if elected, I will not move forward. And then he meets them. How did you find all of that sort of spiritual part? Or was it just great science fiction for you?
I thought it was great science fiction. And I loved how they approach it spiritually. Because, I mean, the context poor Sisko is in while this is happening. He's just been told by Picard that his only job is to unify Bajor. He's just been told by Kira the only way to unify Bajor is through the religion. Then he's told by the religious leader, you are now the emissary, the most important religious figure in the world. What's a guy to do?
But he doesn't know yet. Like I didn't even think Opaka fully understands what the role of emissary is. I mean, when was the last time anybody spoke directly with a prophet? It's, you know, she has this vague idea through text of the coming of the emissary and what it's going to be. But until he actually visits the Celestial Temple, like, I don't even think the prophets know what an emissary is going to be.
Well, she even commented how ironic it was that the emissary was going to be someone who didn't wish to be this.
Yeah.
I love how they treated the religion with so much seriousness. Because, you know, often a lot of, like, the Federation is largely post-religion. You know, and especially Earth is post-religion. And Bajor isn't. And it's treated really respectfully, never as superstition. You know, they prove it's actually wormhole aliens. But I like the way they handle it. And the whole conversation with the prophets, everything that happened in the wormhole, I thought was a really kind of profound way of looking at our experiences through time and the nature of linear time. So I'm a fan. Tom, what did you think of it?
I love the discussions of time and the linear nature of time and the potential fourth, fifth, and sixth dimensions of time and experiencing all facets of time at the same time. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a good 5 to 7 minutes of great science fiction writing. Mm-hmm. What about, I don't know what, if it's the businessman in me or I'm just, you know, innate capitalist, but they get through the wormhole and Sisko immediately says, we've just discovered the first stable wormhole. Do you know what this means? The three of us know what wormholes are. We've been living with wormholes for a long time. Do you think that that was realistic? Because that was as pivotal part of the series as anything. Was that, did that resonate with you guys, or is that just, you know, that's the way it is?
Well, there's 4300. There's a TNG episode that explores this premise where the Enterprise is called to this planet to oversee negotiations for the purchase and acquisition rights of transit to this stable wormhole. You know, and the Ferengi show up and a bunch of other people show up and they're all doing their thing. And in the end, the wormhole collapses and the Ferengi get trapped, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, you know, it would be interesting to see what that would have been a distinct possibility. Bajor stakes a claim to this wormhole and maybe to boost their economy, they auction off transit rights. I mean, that could have been an avenue that they took. But it's, I don't know. I mean, what is Sisko thinking about in terms of, like, you know, oh, this is going to be great for exploration or this is going to be great for the economy? I mean, I'm not sure. But I certainly like the discussion, as you said, the discussion of time that he has in the middle. I had this idea that, you know, before Sisko sets up his own time loop by explaining time to the prophets. So they view time, he explains time and game, and they see time, linear time, as a game, and then go back in time and set up the gates to the wormhole so that he can go through it. But, I mean, that's a long... A bit of a jump to conclusions there.
I love the kind of the wormhole, the stable wormhole was a gift as well, I think. It was a gift from the prophets to Sisko because they obviously knew what his goals were, to unite Bajor and to bring Bajor into the Federation, and giving Bajor a economic and scientific piece of leverage like that is probably the fastest and surest way to meet that goal.
So yeah, well, no Sisko, no profits, right? Because if you see in the mirror universe, there are no profits because Sisko is not there. There is no emissary to bring them back or to introduce them to Bajor, and they can go back to Bajor for the orbs. If Sisko isn't around, the profits don't show up. It's really interesting. And Vedic Barile says that later. He's like, Bajor has no, or mirror Vedic Barile. He's, you know, Bajor has no gods on the other side of the mirror universe. So it is really interesting, his role both in them and their role to him.
How about the introduction of Chief?
Tom, you go first on
and
this
Megan,
one.
And Megan, I knew that was coming from you. So why don't you take the lead on this one?
Okay. Oh, gosh. I mean, you know how I feel about Chief O'Brien. And probably even, I don't know if we've ever gotten into how much admiration I have for Keiko. But that'll come later. I like the conversation he had with Picard. Because there's this wonderful contrast, right, between the way that Picard and O'Brien were interacting. And it was friendly and it was compassionate. And they'd been through things together. And O'Brien knows Picard in a way that Sisko doesn't.
Yeah.
And I almost kind of feel like kind of Picard was leaving O'Brien there, not representing him, but representing what Picard represents. And so looking at O'Brien in that way, and then the relationship that he builds with Sisko and the rest of the team over time, I thought was really interesting, because Sisko and O'Brien got along really well right away. And so I think it bodes very well, but it's nice to see him. And I'm so glad he came to this, to DS9, just like I'm glad Worf will eventually be on DS9. I'm a big O'Brien fan.
Yeah, he definitely, Miles needs a haircut in the first episode, but so does everybody else. So, Yeah, it's nice to see Miles there, but like, where is everybody else? I didn't understand. No other TNG people came to say goodbye. I felt so bad for him. He's alone in Transporter Room 3, poor guy.
I always just thought of him as the direct descendant of Scotty. And just absolutely loved him. You know, the career enlisted man who actually makes everything work, and always cool and calm under pressure.
Yeah.
You know, with Keiko, that we'll get into all of that later. But if there's a beloved character on this show, I have to nominate Chief.
Yeah, Brian's great
for that. What about the introduction of Gul Dukat and the Cardassians?
Oh, I like how Gul Dukat comes in. He's like, "This was my office a week ago," and Sisko sarcastically tells him to drop by whenever. And Gul Dukat, in all earnestness, does not get the sarcasm and thanks him. That's kind of funny. He's a much tamer beast than he becomes. I guess he's kind of set up as a bit of a fall guy in that first episode. But
I don't know, because, I mean, what he's talking about, I mean, like, DS9 was, like, torn apart by the Cardassians before they left under Dukat's order. He's coming back and casually talking about the theft and the kidnapping basically of important religious relics, and almost assuming Sisko's going to want to get in on that action and have a scientific knowledge exchange of these stolen relics. I thought it's just maybe my opinion of it is a little colored by what he does later, but I thought like they set the Cardassians up as just primo villains from minute one, and Dukat just he slimes and oozes from place to place and is so distasteful in a really like strong and compelling way. Just great villain.
It's also a little diplomatically insensitive that he just lets the Cardassians roam around and go to Quarks. I mean, if a Gallicrass warship showed up 2 weeks after the occupation in orbit of Bajor, there'd be kind of a diplomatic incident when with a guy who's been there a day is just like, "Yeah, sure, go hang out at the bar, do what you want." And you just see the Cardassians hanging out playing Tonga. Like, it's, you know.
Megan, you may have actually answered my next question, but where do the Cardassians fit in our pantheon of villains? Because if we start with the Klingons, we do default to honor. If we start with the Romulans, we know they're liars, cheaters, and thieves, but that's what makes them so great and why they have an empire. The Borg, we haven't met the Jem'Hadar yet. Where do you assess the Cardassians, or should they, because they change and morph at some point, but right now they're pretty villainous. Are they just slimy and sleazy? Reptilian, even?
It's hard to find sympathy, especially, you know, at this point, the beginning of the series. Like, the occupying force that has recently been chased off is not a wildly sympathetic, you know, character class. But I think, you know, that desire for power and control, and that feeling of rightness to be in power and have control, I think, I wonder if they even seem more villainous now than they might have when the show was originally airing because of that.
You can look at examples in TNG of the Cardassians, and they're definitely portrayed as villainous, but they lack the nefariousness of the Romulans in the early days and the brutality of the Klingons. Like, they're definitely set up as villains. But unlike Romulus or, you know, like the Klingon homeworld, like, it's, the Cardassians are also portrayed throughout the series as being remarkably artistic in weird ways. I mean, it's undeniably like a fascist art. But they make a lot of references to music and Cardassian literature. You know, at one point, I think Derek talks about something called the repeating epic and how it's the greatest form of classical Cardassian literature. And it's literally just the same story told over and over and over through different points of view, meant to drive home the duty to the state is everything.
Is that why he was very Soviet?
Yes, it is. I mean, they have a high emphasis on, like, culture and being, but it's also your only existence should be to the state. Like, that's your loyalty. Which is interesting. I mean, you don't see that a lot with the Klingons, who are tribal and kind of warlike, and the Romulans, which are all about, like, treachery and deceit. I mean, maybe a little with the, you know, this whole spying thing of the Romulans, but yeah, it's very much a you owe your allegiance to them kind of thing. Which is interesting. I mean, it's completely against the Bajoran ideal of, like, you know, individualism and sort of, we're going to take it to the streets and love of the prophets and stuff like that. Although I guess you could say that the Bajorans are also one note with being religious zealots, but, you know, who knows?
So, in terms of Easter eggs, for me, this entire show is one big Easter egg, probably by design, because I'm going to end with two questions. One, did it work for you? And now looking back or rewatching it, and I rewatched it again last night, but did it work as that transition from TNG to something else? Because clearly they were building on what had been created, and they had to drag all of us Star Trek TNG fans along with them. So, you know, did all that work? And were there any other, you hit Roe, Ensign Roe with Michelle Forbes, because I wondered about that, Murphy. You know, yeah. How different would it have been? And she was such a dynamic character from TNG. But any other Easter eggs we haven't gotten to that you guys really struck you guys or even just enjoyed?
I want to put a little one out there for the introduction of Julian Bashir, the sleaziest skirt chaser that ever graduated Federation Medical School. And I mention it only because of all the character growth in all the Star Treks that have ever been or ever will be. I don't know if there's anyone who did a better job than Julian Bashir. And it was so fun to see him just being awful. As an arrogant young grad, knowing what awaits him. And so I love that. And in terms of, you know, continuing the conversation, I think it did a great job because it did establish, it anchored us with kind of the pivotal moment of Wolf 359. And then there was a direct handover from Picard to Sisko, which I think it was really elegantly done. But they also set it up to be really strange and new. We've got a whole new type of transit through the universe. We've got main principal characters who are not Federation. and a new environment than we've had in Star Trek before. So I think they did a good job of handing over the reins and setting up the new context for the show. Yeah. So I think it was beautifully done.
Murphy?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the transition was really nice. I mean, I'm biased because it's my favorite Star Trek, but I think a lot of, you know, this is, if Star Trek was conceived originally of Roddenberry's idea of wagon train to the stars, right? This is Dodge City. This is Sisko is the sheriff and he has his posse and the action comes to that town and he's got to defend it. And that's a different animal. And that's, I think that was in 93. I think there was a transition for a lot of people. I think that was hard to accept. It's why DS9 remains sort of the kind of outlier, the sort of black sheep of Trek. It's come around a lot. And I think it's due to exceptional writing of just phenomenal storyline that just evolves. But that sort of week by week adventure, you know, they try to do that in the first season. It sort of works. And then they go, you know, start with the second season, they go more serialized. And that's where the series really comes into its own and starts to take shape. But it also makes it, you know, hard for people who aren't watching it week by week. It makes it a little inaccessible. Now, that's fine because it's its own thing. But I think they did a great job. And, I'm happy that they used a lot of stuff. And in fact, I watch New Trek now, and there are more subtle DS9 Easter eggs and bits of lore that are thrown in than almost any other series I can think of from back in the day. It's really interesting. I'm not sure why, but it's just such compelling writing that it's just so much to work with. Even if it's not the you know, with the popularity of TNG or something like Voyager or whatever. Yeah.
So I love your remarks on the, from the wagon train to the stars to Dodge City, because the final line between Dr. Bashir and Kieran DeReese, where he says he wants to be on the frontier, he wants to practice frontier medicine, and she chastises him and says, well, this frontier is my home. Yeah. That's what everybody remembers. But I remember he wanted to be on the frontier. And so I, you know, look at this through different lenses, and the moral flexibility you either need or can engage in when you're on the frontier can make for some really interesting questions. And I know we're going to explore them through the episodes that the three of us have selected. But I love that kind of component. I'm always fascinated when actors who perform in completely different genres change that. So Rene Auberjonian.
Oh yeah. Oh boy.
He was a stand-up comedian. And for those who may not remember, he was the original Father Mulcahy.
He was
in the MASH movie.
In the MASH movie. And he was a bit player in a lot of Altman films. I mean, he shows up in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and he shows up in a whole bunch of other stuff that that Altman did over the years. And you know, you sort of see him without this makeup, but it still looks remarkably like him. Yeah, he's a fantastic, fantastic actor.
And he obviously has a lot of growth to come as well. Sisko's either use or manipulation of Quark. I love that scene. I don't know if he intended to do that all along or it just sort of came to him. But Quark is exactly the kind of person you want. Sort of a leader of the civilian population. Because everybody's going to come to Quark's. And they do. And the interplay between Odo and Quark, it's almost a game between them, which I really, really, really loved. One other thing that I'll pick up on in a later episode, which is when the Defiant appears. Turned out that Sisko had been one of the engineers on the original plans for the construction of the Defiant. What I had forgotten was when he came to Deep Space Nine, that was the assignment he was on. He took a 3-year hiatus after Wolf 359 to essentially put himself back together. Yep. And that's where Star Trek sent him. And the Defiant, as he reminds us, was designed originally to fight the Borg. And that's why it was so overpowered, so fast, et cetera. And so I love that sort of tie-in as well. The episode absolutely worked for me for all of the reasons that we've talked about on this pod. But remember, they were trying to transition to something very different than perhaps what Gene Roddenberry had originally conceived of. And they had to bring us all along.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. So I guess we should go around for kind of final thoughts. So, Murphy, what were your final thoughts on these two episodes, which became The Emissary?
So I love it. I mean, I think it's a great way to jump into the series. You know, it's like I said, it's a little more of a cohesive story than Encounter at Farpoint or you know what the pilot for TOS was, the Cage, I believe, which is leftovers from the previous pilot. And even Voyager was good. It had its, but it was sort of all over the place. But this really sets us up in a spot. It's, this is the locale, this is the town, these are the people. This is, you know, they set up the Denorius Belt and they'll set up the Badlands. They're setting up this Western landscape. And it really, I mean, it really comes together. And it's, yeah, just a fantastic cast, fantastic writing, and something completely new that just hadn't been tried before. And it's just amazing.
Megan?
I think my only other final thought is one thing we just didn't touch on too much yet is Sisko as dad, which is one of my favorite parts of DS9. And I love that they introduced Jake right away. And I love that they established that wonderful father-son relationship right off the bat. And watching that change and develop over time, not only is it wonderful to see, but it anchors us in their timeline so well, growing up with somebody. Mm-hmm. And so I love that about it. And I'm so excited that we're doing this and having the opportunity to dig into DS9 again.
I'm going to end by shouting out to baseball, my favorite sport. I love the way this episode started with a baseball, and baseball's going to be with us the whole time. I have my own Willie Mays signed baseball, and so did Captain Sisko. So, guys, this has been a ton of fun for our premiere episode of this season, because that's what heroes do. I look forward to continuing this conversation.
Catch you next time.
As do I. Yes, lots of fun.
This is Tom Fox again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Because That's What Heroes Do. This season, we'll be taking up the 15 top episodes of Deep Space Nine as curated by myself, Megan Doherty, and our colleague, Murphy. We're going to have a ton of fun, and I hope you will join us for what we all believe is one of the very top Star Trek series, although sometimes less appreciated than TOS, TNG, or other series. The award-winning Because That's What Heroes Do is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network.